back, everybody. It's time again to the Private Investing and Business Hour on OC Talk Radio, where we discuss the insider information that you need to know about raising capital in today's changing environment. So if you're an investor, an entrepreneur, pull up a chair, slip off your shoes, and let's get started here with our host. Host today, Jim Butts from CalCap Partners.
Why, thanks, Paul. And today I'm here with Herb Bedell. And Herb is someone who's been is a judge and has been involved with various concepts, and one of them is restraining orders. And it ends up that it's quite useful for people in business to understand more about restraining orders. So, Herb, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Why don't you take a couple minutes and explain, you know, like who you are, what you're doing, what your background is, and so people get a better understanding of your expertise in this area.
Well, I started out as a lawyer, and I was an entertainment lawyer for a while, then went into the district attorney's office as a prosecutor, then went into transactional work as an entertainment business affairs person. And I started doing civil and criminal litigation. I was appointed to the bench in 2008 by then presiding judge Stephen Zuliger as what's called the judge pro tem, meaning that I sit on assignment on a part-time basis, which is mostly about half the time now. And I'm assigned to various different courts to cover for judges that are either on vacation, sick, in school, or whatever, or retired. And I was assigned to restraining orders, which I knew nothing about, around 2009, and started doing temporary restraining orders and hearings on requests for permanent injunctions. And so I've represented people as a lawyer in restraining order cases, as well as defending them. And for the last 5 or 6 years, I've been adjudicating them from the judicial perspective. And that's pretty much what I've been doing.
So a lot of people know the term restraining orders, I think I mentioned when we were talking just ahead of time, because they heard it on Law and Order on TV. And most of those are involved with domestic abuse issues. You're not talking about that, correct? You're talking about how they're in business. So talk a little bit about how you would use these in business.
Well, a restraining order is a prior restraint. It means that a court, either on a temporary basis or on a permanent basis, permanent being usually about 3 years. However, the actual entry of the judgment, either a temporary restraining order or a permanent one, is on your record for life. Literally for life. It cannot come off for any reason. That's the state of the law. So if somebody gets a temporary restraining order against you, or you want to get one against somebody else, that's a life-altering event. When you want to get a job, for a business person, knowing this information is helpful. I spoke to a CEO of a big corporation not too long ago, and I asked him, I said, well, what would you do if you did a background check and you saw there was a restraining order against the applicant? And he said, you know, off the record, our human resources people wouldn't get to step two with that person because we wouldn't want to take the chance of walking into some kind of liability section. Because realistically, some judge someplace, some neutral person, has decided that they're unstable or they're untrustworthy or they're unreliable, and the immediate impression, the perception is, I don't want anything to do with this person. And so the restraining order basically says you can't do or say certain things. It includes saying, because if people are now abusing the internet and social media by putting on a lot of things that are damaging and defamatory. And so if it goes on and you could satisfy the court that it's not justified, and then it's compared to free speech, then you get a restraining order against them texting and doing things on the social media and everything else. It's become quite broad, actually, in terms of speech. But it's a balancing between free speech. Doesn't allow somebody to yell fire in a crowded movie theater. Right. Free speech versus restraint by the government from doing things that you think you're entitled to do. In fact, the people who deal with Second Amendment issues, gun issues, are real concerned because the minute there's a restraining order, either kind, temporary or permanent, You have to give up all your weapons. You have to surrender them within 24 hours, notify the court within 48 hours. Otherwise, you're in contempt of court, and that's a crime. So you got to give up the guns. One guy told me not too long ago that he's a hunter. And this is a killer for him because he can no longer carry his rifle. And so there are far-reaching ramifications in terms of getting these orders.
So I want to make sure that I heard this right. So when you use the word temporary, but you said that if you have a restraining order put up against you, it's there for life. So
including the temporary one.
What's the concept of temporary then? What does the word temporary mean if it goes for life?
Well, the concept of temporary is that until you get a hearing, there's things going on out there.
Okay.
And so the person who feels threatened or the person who thinks they're entitled to a restraining order wants to get immediate relief. So they file what's called the CH-100 in California, a request for a temporary restraining order. And if the court grants it, and it's ex parte, meaning the court doesn't hear from the other side. It only hears from the person applying. They could say whatever they want. And we don't know how true it is.
Right.
So we look at it, and it looks like it's something real serious, and you grant a temporary restraining order. It's good for up to 21 days and could be extended until there's a hearing where the other side gets a chance to respond. But the temporary restraining order, when it's issued, includes a surrender of the gun or any other weapons, and it includes temporary relief, but it's on the record if you get stopped for a traffic violation and you're within, say, 100 yards of the person that you've been restrained against, or you have a restraining order against, you're in trouble.
So
that's there, and you didn't even know anything about it. You got served with a document saying there's going to be a hearing in 3 weeks.
Right.
You know, somebody's trying to do this to you. So it's pretty. The temporary has a tremendous impact because it becomes part of what's called the CLET system. California Law Enforcement Technology System. It's also a public record. It goes on your credit. It's a horrible thing to have. Temporary just means what it says, just for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But the effect is permanent.
Now, so you have a temporary restraining order that's placed against you, and then means you're going to have a trial within a certain amount of time. You're going to go in front of the court.
You're going to
have a hearing.
Hearing,
yes. That's
right.
So go in front of the court because there's a trial was probably the wrong words to use.
Well, no, that's not the wrong word. It's a quasi trial. It's basically the taking of evidence, but there are different rules.
Right.
For example, as to hearsay, in a temporary restraining order, you can say anything, and it's admissible, even if it's hearsay. Hearsay is a legal concept that doesn't allow for out of court statements made by third parties that is being offered for the truth. And so, but hearsay is admissible in restraining order cases, even though we don't have to give it a lot of weight. It's still admissible.
Now, if you had a restraining order placed against you, a temporary restraining order, and you go to court, and the court finds that whatever it was that was brought up just isn't valid, and they, what did they use the word, vacate, or they
no, you just deny, you deny the petition.
Petition, okay. In denying
the petition for a permanent restraining order, and you, as a matter of operation of law, the TRO then expires.
Right. Does that come off your records?
There's nothing on there except the record.
So there's nothing that follows you for life that says you had a restraining order placed against you?
No, it is. It's still staying.
It is. Okay. So that's actually...
It's permanent.
Wow.
It doesn't come off. It'll show that on such and such a date, a temporary restraining order was issued by such and such a court. And for example, I rode with the sheriff not too long ago, a friend of mine, and he showed me how it worked on the computer. You punch in certain information, and there it comes. The date that it was issued, by whom it was issued, and what the restraining order is, so that the cop in the field knows exactly what they're encountering if they stop somebody or if somebody complains about violation of the restraining order. Violation of the restraining order is a crime.
Sure.
You get arrested.
So let me, because this is pretty interesting to me right at the moment. Let's say I'm a business owner, and for whatever reason, I had an employee that was kind of like acting up or whatever they were doing, and they decided to fabricate some story and go in front of a judge and get a restraining order for whatever reason. Now, that's against me, and it's going to stay for life. As a business owner, what would you recommend that business owner do in order to mitigate as much as possible the effects of what would happen because of that restraining order?
Well, first of all, a party who has a restraining order issued against them, or if, even if it's denied, has no rights in California to sue for malicious prosecution. They may have some employment issues.
Right.
And those are sometimes pretty expensive.
Right.
You have to be very careful, and you got to walk that line between conduct that is acceptable and conduct which is not acceptable. In the workplace cases, they generally deal with violence, credible threats of violence, as opposed to normal civil harassment, which is you're annoying me. You'd be surprised in the hundreds of cases that I've seen from the bench. The stories that come up are outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are laughable if they weren't so serious.
Right.
But an employer is faced with a difficult choice. If they don't do anything and it turns out that that person reasonably was a threat of some kind and they didn't get a restraining order, they're going to get sued for negligence or for failing to do due diligence in determining who is still at the workplace.
Right.
And that's not something you really want to be caught up in the middle of, if there's a tragic event like, you know, we see them on television all the time.
Yeah.
Somebody goes into the post office and blows away 15 people.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this is, an opportunity, to be heard. But if you're on the other side and you're an employee, you know, the risk is enormous.
Right. I believe that what you were talking about now is I'm an employer and I see that there's something going on with somebody and it's possible that if the normal, an average person looked at that, they'd be very concerned about it. And if I didn't somehow do something about that and that person did react and cause problems, then I could really lose my business or whatever if this all comes out.
You get sued.
Right.
If you haven't got insurance or not enough insurance.
Yeah.
And you have a financial risk.
So that's that part of it. What about employees who put restraining orders against businesses or companies or, you know, people that own companies?
You can't do that.
It
has to be against an individual.
They do a restraining order against the owner of the company for some reason. Does that happen often?
No.
Okay. I'm just trying to figure out because there's business people listening.
I don't think I've ever seen one, actually.
Okay, good. That would, because I'm thinking about somebody, if they wanted to really be malicious and harmful, they could place a restraining order against somebody who's going to follow them for life.
Well, they could file an individual request for restraining order that has nothing to do with employment, and they can get it. They can get that restraining order if they can prove it.
Yeah.
It gets into a swearing contest. These cases are decided basically on what's called a burden of proof.
Okay.
Burden of proof meaning clear and convincing evidence has to be established that they fit within the statute, which is Section 527.8, for anybody who's interested, in the California Code of Civil Procedure. And the reality is that these restraining orders aren't really limited, except it has to be to a person.
Mm-hmm.
A person can only get one, and you can only get one against a person.
Now, I also saw that state by state, the rules around these things, restraining orders, can vary.
Oh, they vary dramatically.
Okay.
Now, keep in mind, these are not domestic violence cases we're talking about.
Right.
Domestic violence cases are usually heard in the family court, and they're, even though the general requirements are the same, generally, they're heard in an entirely different context.
Hmm. Now, if you were giving advice to someone who's in business, what advice would you give them, or what kinds of things should they think about in terms of when is it applicable, when should they be thinking about it, and under what circumstances should they go and at least talk to their lawyer about what's going on?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is document everything.
Okay.
And then I think you should show that you made an effort to resolve it as best you could. Now, these cases involve continuing courses of conduct.
Mm-hmm.
A one-time event doesn't qualify for a restraining order, not generally.
Okay.
Unless there's a credible threat of violence that's going to result based on what previously happened, so you have a history.
Right.
Document everything, because you may be facing an employment or a discrimination case down the road. They will oftentimes say things happened that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So document everything. And if you decide to go for a restraining order, you should give them some advance notice that you're doing that. Give them an opportunity to resolve whatever the issues are on their own. and then you get someone to file the proper papers for you. Isn't something that you should do on your own. In fact, almost every employer case, there's a lawyer because individuals cannot represent the corporation without being a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So all these corporate entities have a lawyer that do this for them. They appear.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, the victims, and I'm using that word loosely,
mm-hmm.
Don't appear. That the testimony is taken by way of declaration, so there's not even a cross-examination.
Mm.
In fact, in celebrity stalking cases, you rarely see the celebrities, every now and again. But for the most part, there's a declaration as to what's going on. It's the same thing with these types of cases. Much is decided on hearsay declarations from third parties that are not there.
So the other group of people that will be listening to the show are sort of individual investors. And it sounds like if you know, given the conversation you had with that CEO, that, you know, if you found out that the person you were interviewing had a restraining order against him, what would you do? And you wouldn't get any further. Does it make sense for somebody who's looking to invest in a company to do some background checks on individuals who are putting the company together?
Well, I certainly would inquire of management
mm-hmm.
if they've had any issues with any of the employees. First, you want to know how many employees there are. If it's a mm-hmm. startup and there's only two people, that one's pretty easy.
Sure.
You know, is there any history among the various people that would lead you to believe that there's a possibility that something will happen at the workplace?
Mm-hmm.
And the workplace is a pretty broad term. You know, if you're a company that's doing business in many different places, the workplace is many different places.
Right.
So you want to know certainly if there's any issues with any of the employees. That's the first thing, because you don't want to buy a company that's looking at a lawsuit down the road.
Right. I'm also thinking now that, because something you just said made me think about something else. When you talk about the broadness of a company, there are a number of places that are virtual companies where the people are actually working in a defined area inside their house. I'm assuming now that becomes part of the definition of the workplace.
Yeah, but the chances are there's little personal contact.
Okay.
If everybody's working in their own environment and they're not even seeing each other, I mean, it's possible, but it has to be a credible threat of violence.
Hmm.
And it's pretty hard if you're in Cincinnati and somebody else is in Chicago.
Right.
That anything's going to happen. Ultimately, that's a waste of time and money to try to
sure.
get an injunction under those circumstances.
Okay, good.
That's just an opinion.
That's something that's, I just thought of this as kind of a, if I could put my own story together on it, it would be something where somebody was working at home and they were really frustrated with someone and they said something to someone else that basically said, if this doesn't get resolved, I'll take on myself, I'll go down and shoot them.
Well, yeah, that certainly is doable.
Right.
I would venture to say that in the many, many petitions that I've read, they almost always say they threaten to kill me.
Right.
It becomes a mantra. I'm afraid for my life because he came by and he said such and such and such and such.
Right.
That's the general allegations that are made in these petitions.
Right.
And then the respondents is usually, I never said anything of the kind. I don't even know him. I wasn't anywhere near it, whatever it is.
Right.
And it becomes a triable issue for the court to determine. And then you decide as a judge whether or not the petitioner has proven by clear and convincing evidence that they are truly justified in seeking this kind of relief.
Now, one of the things that you said that business people should do in this respect is to document all the things, and it's under multiple occasions. You just need to keep good documentation. I mean, it ends up you need to do that for employee anyway, but especially in this perspective. Are there any other things that you would recommend that business people do in order to make sure they're doing this properly?
Just get good representation.
And
because it's a technical subject. There are requirements, and if you miss something, you're not going to get the desired relief. And it, in certain circumstances, and by the way, I spoke to the general counsels of two major, major corporations. When you call somebody like that, and you tell them that you're a judge and you have a quick question, they talk to you for some
mm-hmm.
reason or another. And I tell them that it would be all confidential, that I was just inquiring, because I do a little speech when I take the bench. About how it could affect your work and your ability to get a job or keep a job. And they said the same thing that the guy told me when I met him in the movies, in the theater. My wife and I were at the theater and they were sitting next to us. And he was the CEO of this big corporation that came out in conversation. So ultimately, the reality is that, it's a scarlet letter for you if it's on your name.
So when you talk about getting credible, you should, I'm assuming, are there lawyers who specialize in this, or do all lawyers have a background in it?
I doubt that many do.
Right.
It's kind of like a niche of a kind, and it requires a, well, a fairly large volume of knowledge of the subject. You don't go into court looking like an idiot.
Right.
Specialize? I don't know very many people who specialize in it.
Right.
I suppose on the websites or the internet you can find people, but you gotta look to see what they do. If it's a personal injury lawyer just looking for extra business, that's not who you want.
Right.
You're not looking for a corporate tax person.
Right.
You know, you're looking for somebody that does this on a regular basis, and there are not very many people who do. I do it as a consultant.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you want to know about anything dealing with restraining orders, you can go to my website, which is restrainingorders.expert, restrainingorders.expert, and you can read the articles.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's actually a really good thing for people to be able to do, because now you're going to get into, I'm assuming, haven't been there, but I will be after the show, that this is pretty specific to what we're talking about, as opposed to you go to Wikipedia and everything's mixed together with, you know, it's personal stuff and it's business stuff and such. So I think that that's really great. It's good that you have it. I understand you're also in the midst of creating a book on the subject.
I am, actually, and it's going to hopefully be published in the winter of 2016. The editors are working on it.
Okay.
And it has a large chapter, maybe too large, large chapter on restraining orders. The book is tentatively entitled From the Trench to the Bench.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically how the legal system works, with stories about how things happen. Real, true life stories.
Great. You know, the time just really flies. We're just about over with our segment. If somebody wants to get in touch with you some way, is there a best way to do it?
Yeah, just go to the website, restrainingorders.expert, and there's a contact information there. If anybody is interested in consulting with me on the subject, I have very few limitations. I don't take any consultations where an appearance is necessary in any court where I preside.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's the only limitation, but I give people advice.
Well, Herb, this has been very instructive for me, and I really appreciate you coming on and talking about it. I'm sure other people will, too. So thank you again for appearing, and I look forward to your book coming out, and look forward to reading your stuff on your website.
Well, thanks very much. It was an enjoyable event this morning. Thanks.
Thanks. Just a quick note. In going to Herb's site, the expert is the extension, .expert, so don't be looking for a .com, .net, .org. It's .expert. And Paul, it's time for you to take us to a commercial. Thanks.
So let's do a shout out to the sponsor of today's program, CalCap Partners. CalCap Partners is the manager of venture capital funds specializing in investing in kind of what we're talking about today, small to medium-sized technology-based businesses with high growth potential. CalCap manages equity and debt investments into companies that meet the investment criteria of our various funds. Managers of previous investment transactions collectively exceeding U.S. $2 billion. That's what they bring to the table here. And operations in the U.S., California, New York, Canada, including Ontario and British Columbia. And they include a global network of strategic resources consisting of managerial talent and capital resources that truly add value to our portfolio companies. For more information on all the things that they provide and all the things that they do and the funds that they work with, why not just visit the website, CalCap Partners, that's plural, CalCapPartners, CalCapPartners.com. And now back to our show.
Hi, thanks, Paul, and welcome back to the commercial. And for this segment, I'm talking with Greg Solomon, And Greg is with an investing company. And I'll let him tell you about who they are and what he does. Greg, why don't you take a couple minutes and tell people who you are and sort of your background?
Sounds good. Thanks for introducing me, Jim. So I'm currently with Primary Funding, and we are a business lender that provides small to medium-sized companies nationwide with capital, typically to bridge to our banking partners that have programs for them, you know, that we'll take care of in the long term. Mm-hmm. Personally, I've been in lending all my post-collegiate life, and have now going on a little over 22 years of just pure lending in the space, and really enjoyed the last couple of years, especially because of a lot of the business opportunities that we've been able to facilitate.
So, what are you seeing in terms of entrepreneurs and what's happening in Southern California? I know you're specifically San Diego County, but I would imagine that you also understand a little bit more about what's happening in maybe Orange County or Riverside County. But if it's just San Diego County, that's fine too.
Yeah, you know, we have, again, we're nationwide, but being in San Diego the last 20 years gives us a specific, you know, viewpoint at San Diego and the surrounding areas. And I would say we could speak, at least in our most current year and probably Southern California, defined as San Diego and probably Inland Empire, Riverside area in terms of the growth. And specifically, you know, industry-wide, we've been seeing a return of manufacturing in a strong way. Probably the year previously to this, and before that, we saw a lot of oil-related companies that we were helping in the Midwest, and obviously we know from recent events this year what's gone on there. So the really a lot of the focus we've seen, though, has been manufacturing, distribution, and staffing companies that have provided both of them.
Hmm. So what's your sweet spot of the type of loans that you're looking for?
Generally for us, historically, we've done deals in the $100,000 to $3 million range. Mm-hmm. We certainly can consider up to $10 million. We don't see them a lot, mainly from our banking partners, is where we've been getting deals from mostly of our 20-year history. So that relegates us into the spot where the deals that maybe aren't quite bankable or maybe have been exited, depending on the time frame, have been in those spaces. Mm-hmm. We have some alliances with SBA groups as well.
Okay.
And so sometimes we'll go down the ladder a little bit to help somebody on a startup basis, you know, like $50,000 a month on some type of receivables facility, something like that.
That's actually interesting to know. Your appetite of $100,000 to $3 million, that covers a really wide range of business needs that aren't covered, for example, by equity investors very easily anymore. It's that, especially if you get above like a million, between 1 and 4 million, there's just nothing there in terms of equity. So the idea that you got some things in terms of debt. What kind of debt instruments are you issuing?
Specifically, we have done asset-based credit lines as probably a predominant vehicle towards that. We also have some factoring related, you know, or invoice specific programs. And then we have opened up with term loans as well. So our best program, generally the Just Miss Banking, will be just a pure credit line, and specific to, you know, getting the business there. But I would say probably in 2015, we've seen a major resurgence for the asset-based lines. Maybe a year ago was more factoring.
Mm-hmm.
But as people have certainly jumped out of the recession issues into more of a growth mode, we've gone up the ladder a bit in terms of the quality and the size, and so we've been filling more needs in that, I'd say, ABL, you know, based credit line mm-hmm. sweet spot.
So do you attribute the rise in asset base with the rise in manufacturing?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Great question. And absolutely, we've no doubt seen a specific rise to that. But We've also, you know, in the suppliers to the manufacturing sector or the distributors that work with some of their products, we've seen that rise to short-term staffing companies or temporary staffing agencies, as they're known, really boomed for us, and not just for primary funding, but lenders in our space, because a lot of the companies that have come back cautiously instead of full-time. They've certainly hired the temporary workers that they can vet a little bit longer before they do bring them into their payroll full-time.
Yeah, the I think that that's interesting, and I you know, the idea of tying something to you seeing some resurgence, and all of a sudden there's more of a certain kind of loan. What I like about that is it shows your ability to react to the change in the environment, which, you know, entrepreneurs should like. When you're doing things like a bridge loan, maybe I'll ask this differently. What is it that you're finding when people are coming to you, you're looking for something? And I'll tell you specifically why I pulled back from bridge loan. California Capital Partners used to be a venture debt fund, and we used to work with earlier stage companies back when we were formed in 2006. And one of the things we would find was people would come and say, I want a bridge loan. And when I talk to them, it's like, a bridge to where? What are you trying to do? You know, you couldn't for the life of you figure out, you know, what does this mean? Or somebody would give you something, they give you some, I mean, one company I really thought that they would be very savvy, because there were two of the principals that one of them was bought out by Microsoft, had an exit to Microsoft, and another one had an exit to another big tech company. So you figured they know what they were talking about. And something didn't make sense, and I asked them for a little bit more of their financials. They sent me their entire financials. And it found out that they had a bridge loan that was already outstanding. They were trying to get another bridge loan, and their initial one was going to end in June, and then they said, well, we're talking, you know, we're going to get a VC round. And I said, who are you talking to? Well, we're going to talk to a bunch of people. I said, it's February. If you're not talking to them now, you're not going to get the loan. You're not going to get the investment. So it was like such nonsense stuff that was coming out. What kind of things do you see that entrepreneurs do that just negate them from being able to work with you?
They do a lot of things. Unfortunately, it's hard to pick a starting point for that right. Make them not want to work with us. But, you know, a lot of them certainly do want to work with us, but the items that negate them generally is a lack of true audited financials or true CPA-oriented financials or a systematic process in terms of their submitting their financials for any kind of regular review or properly allocated expenses. It's amazing what we see all over the place. So it's hard for us to ascertain the assets of a company or the cash flow of a company properly. And specifically what we're looking for in our, you know, particular means of getting them funding are the assets of the company, whether it's the accounts receivable, the equipment, the you know, the IP, the inventory, whatever it may be, and we sometimes look at some of these financials and just try to understand what the heck, where the heck, and how the heck. So that, in a nutshell, is, you know, one of the probably the more frustrating things, because we certainly have the ability to help most businesses that can help themselves.
Right. So one of the things I used to find is that people, when they would come to you and give you some representation of their asset value, when you ask them how they did it, well, we figured that we paid this much for it and this is how much it's worth. It's like no third party was done. So obviously, you know, it's like you're going to say that your car is always worth more than what the blue book value is. And that would drive us a little crazy always. So, that can sort of get in the way of being productive. When you talk about the assets, the asset loans, what is it specifically? I know that you talked about it. So audited results are important to you. Are you also looking at, you know, who valued your business? I mean, there's some companies that I know, I'm very friendly with one. I won't mention them just because this is someone else, you know, it's a show. But they do, that's what they do. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that they do is early stage companies, because nobody knows how to value the intellectual property they might have in the business. And if you don't have the third party do it, it just doesn't make any sense. what kind of things stop you when you look at it? If somebody says, well, this is what it is, and they come back and they start telling you what it is, and you look at it and say, I can't accept that.
Yeah, that's a good segue from your earlier question. I think for us, luckily, not a lot stops us once we have particular assets that we internally value. So mm-hmm. I got to clarify that because, I'm saying nothing really stops us. Well, from the point of, what is our actual, say, loan to value or advance mm-hmm. mechanism on that asset? And so typically, you're right, it comes in overvalued. Mm-hmm. It's rarely ever valued by an outside third party. And in our annual revenue ranges of these companies, it's something they haven't really thought through. Mm-hmm. So generally, they'll tell us I'm looking at a deal right now where they're telling us the value is $600,000. It's a manufacturer. It's local here in Southern California. And they're saying $600,000. Well, we've kind of cut it in half internally on our own valuation, said roughly about $350,000. And the advance line that we're going to do with the equipment in mind is about $250,000.
Right.
So that's, in our world, we can say, for this particular case, we feel comfortable on the character of the company, because we certainly look at character and who's running it is still very, very important to us. And then we look at the collateral and say, okay, well, we're still good, overall. The leverage here is fine. And then, thirdly, we're looking at the process flow of how they're going to produce ROI from that, credit line we give them. And so if we can back into those three things, we can kind of subtract from the overall asset value and still feel comfortable with our overall lending.
So it sounded like the maximum amount that you would give is like roughly about two thirds of what the actual value is. Is that something that
That's correct.
Okay. I did it in my head. So it's, that's why I said it like as a question, because I could be wrong in my head. Is that sort of a standard practice? And I'm actually asking that in terms of if somebody's thinking about that, it's something they should think about when they're putting together their idea about what they're going to do. So is like 66% a normal number?
Yeah, typically we'll look at up to 80% of an asset valuation. And then if we actually pull in, say, the other pieces of the company that we talked about, if the financials look good, if the character of the leadership is good, if the process flow is good, we can sometimes go up from that number, mm-hmm. Slightly. And if it doesn't, the other pieces don't look as good, certainly we can go down. And sometimes we'll put a two-stage deal together where we'll say maybe we'll look at funding some of the purchase orders of a company, which is not discussed as an asset a lot. But and we'll say maybe we do 60-65% of the purchase orders, and then we'll do 80% of the actual receivables, and we'll kind of tie those together. And then maybe once we get to the actual true ABL line, that we've seen a lot of demand for, we'll go 75-80% mm-hmm. of that overall. So generally 75-80% is a good guideline.
Now, when we used to do the lending ourselves, we would take the assets and tie it up into something called a UCC-1. Is that what you guys use?
You nailed it once again, Jim.
Okay.
Absolutely, UCC-1 filed it each and every time.
Right now, and the thing that entrepreneurs need to understand about it is that when that's tied up, if they default, you take the assets, but they still own the company. And that's not something that's very well understood. I mean, we had to foreclose on a beer company at one point in time, and we owned the assets, so we owned everything that could make money for them, including the formula, all the relationships with the Tax and Trade Bureau, etc. But he still owned the name of the company and the company and all the debts going into the company. So it is just one of the things that people should understand with their eyes open when they get into something like that. And, just make sure you're making your payments. When you're, went through a list of things that would break a deal, make a deal, but not make it. What are the top three things that you find that people are not doing that they should do that would really get them in a better position when they're going through this?
Yeah, I would say currently in this fiscal period that we're in, we're seeing 90% of the companies submit to us are growth-oriented. So, you know, which is a reversal from maybe just a couple of years ago where it was survival mode. So, you know, fortunately, coast to coast, but even more specifically here in San Diego and locally, the growth orientation of some of these companies is phenomenal, the trajectory. And the number one thing that they haven't planned for is that. You know, most of our companies have been, unfortunately, taken by surprise of some of their recent success, and so they're accepting jobs without the cash to back it up. And that is a really risky proposition that can, you know, ultimately jeopardize a company. Numerous cases, or I can just tell you right now, where we're usually working with a bank, some of the local banks are, again, where we get 90% of our transactions from, and we've been working a long time. And long story short, they've already got a cap line in place or an SBA 7(a) program, and then they also get a ginormous order that you know, represents 25% of their yearly profits, and they take it, they accept it, without knowing how they're going to fill it. So that's the number one issue. The second issue that we see is that people don't have the owners don't wear too many hats, and at the right designated time have not brought in the right talent to take one of those hats away. And specifically, we're talking once again about, say, a controller or somebody of the financial ability to separate out the numbers, work with the banker specifically, and know how to raise some of the funds. The owner is still trying to take that on and doesn't want to spend the money for that person, which I understand, but at the same time holds them back from achieving what they need to. So, that, you know, that, probably that's the two top things. I don't, the third thing could be a combination of the above, but I think those two top things are some good advice for, you know, business owners to focus better on.
You know, one of the things I find, because I mentor a lot of early stage companies, and one of the things that I find is people have their mindset towards it's either or. I'm either going to get some equity investment or I'm going to go get a loan someplace. And they don't understand that in certain industries, you're better off to have a certain money's going for certain things. And then other money's going for something else. Just because it doesn't make sense to give equity with things that are going to really generate some cash, and you can keep your equity. You need to have some, you'll get some value for equity, but don't put it all in equity because, well, in some cases, equity investors won't invest in certain things. It's kind of like, you know, you're not going to get them to invest in lab equipment. They want to have it. VCs want their money to go towards engineers, or people that are actually going to generate money, not capital equipment. So it's always better to have that. It's good that you're talking about that. When this call's over, we need to talk because I actually may have some business for you. If you're looking at some of these things, and these, are there industries, for example, that you stay away from?
Great question. Typically, we have been adverse to more the medical-related or pharma-related industries due to their complex structures with some VCs or angels or some of their debt raising series. And so it's tougher for us to come in and grab a true UCC-1 placement, just by the nature of that. But other than those, traditionally, construction industry is a little harder for most of us to help. We have been doing some construction-related deals this year that have made sense to us when normally we haven't, and mainly because they're growth-oriented. But I would say that, you know, those industries, medical or construction related, where it involves some progress payments or some bonding issues or a retention type of business is a little tougher to underwrite properly.
Right. When you say medical, you're talking about equipment as opposed to pharma?
Both. In the medical industry, what I'm actually specifically to clarify that is where Medi-Cal, Medicare, the type of billing enters into the overall equation of one of their assets of their AR. And it typically is slowed down for them and their earnings and reporting, and it's a lag of 90 days, and which, again, makes just the whole structure a little harder to underwrite and fund properly.
Yeah, that gets to be in the way. I give a lot of credit to people that are going to start something in the medical industry. Because one of the things I, as an investor, want to know is, so give me your, you know, tell me what your plan is, and then tell me how much you're going to make, you know, what kind of revenues you're going to make, which then is predicated on the fact you're going to know how much you can charge. And when you get into these things that have to have the approvals, well, the first thing you have to do is get the FDA approval that says that you can sell it. And just because you have that doesn't mean anything until you go to Center for Medicare and Medicaid and the CMS, and they price it. And those things are, first of all, disparate. They're not done in the same time. So it always amazes me that people are able to get multiple rounds of venture capital when two of the most critical numbers that you need just aren't known. You're not going to know when it's going to be available or how much you're going to charge for it. So that would drive me crazy. It would actually drove me to a position where I wouldn't want to have anything to do with it. And I actually did a turnaround on a local company that CMS redoes their pricing every so often. And they left the pricing out for this is a cardiac monitor, and for there were companies that were using that as a service, and CMS had approved pricing, and the approved pricing was like $250, and they left it off. They forgot to include it, and their process for doing that was it went to the miscellaneous, the bit bucket down at the bottom, and the maximum you could charge is $50. It put companies out of business. It was just ridiculous. And that was like, oh, well, we'll catch it next time. Well, next time's like 5 years. So what do you want me to do over that period of time? So
right.
I appreciate the issues with the medical. Although now that we're in San Diego County, I mean, this is the hub for wireless medical devices. And it seems to be a lot of companies growing up that are getting involved with it. There's a lot of pure talent here with people like Eric Topper. And the things that he's doing over at Scripps. So, very interesting.
It is interesting times.
So actually, we're almost talking for 22 minutes here. If somebody wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way for them to be able to do that?
I think they can certainly reach out to me directly through our primary funding website, www.primaryfunding.com. Or simply they can reach me at gsolomon@primaryfunding.com, which is gsalomon @primaryfunding.com. And certainly we're glad to help anybody that is really trying to grow their companies the right way.
Great. Well, it was great talking to you and great learning more about what you're doing. And good luck. And hang on, I want to talk to you some more.
Yeah, enjoy our time.
Take care.
You've been listening to the only show that talks about the real-world examples, the real-life stories of venture capitalists today. California Business Investing Hour, brought to you by CalCap Partners, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, octalkradio.net.